Welcome to the Millennial Therapist Podcast with Mao and Nao.
This podcast is hosted by two millennial therapists who are true crime, forensic psychology, and macabre obsessed.
This is not your typical mental health podcast where only mental health and social work topics are discussed. We dabble in various topics from cultural humility to military mental health to ghosts to interesting ways our parents use the paranormal to discipline us. Ed Kukui, anyone?
Why so many topics? Because we're millennials. To make things more interesting, one is an Air Force veteran and a mom of two. The other is currently serving active duty. And both are children of immigrants working to honor their ancestors. Warning, listener discretion is advised.
Okay, let's do it. Welcome back to another Millennial Therapist Podcast episode. This is Nao.
And Mao.
Woo woo! Yeah, Mao did an awesome job of doing an episode on the BTK killer along with our good friend Lexi. And we just had a lot to say, but at the same time, we were just speechless. Yeah. Come to the realization, all of this crap like ended in 2005. 2005!
Yes.
We're going to get a little even weirder, and we're going to talk about the dark web.
Dun, dun, dun. I'm so excited.
What have you heard about the dark web?
I think the dark web, I was just like, there's a specific website that you go to. Still think that to this day. I
heard about the dark web, and of course, the number one thing that came to me is like, all the illegal stuff happens there probably. I guess you have to have some kind of special software that would enable you to access the dark web, like you can't just like Google it, which would be
Makes sense. Right? Oh, so it's not on the Google is what you're telling me.
It's not on the Googles. I just went to YouTube and I looked up the dark web. Mm-hmm. So that's my number one source, YouTube. I kind of started a little bit lighthearted and I went with this BuzzFeed video. He's a former mob boss. I think his name is Michael Francis. And I think somebody in their staff has access to the dark web. They went ahead and uploaded a video of them dancing like in silly costumes. But I guess you got to pay like $50 to watch it.
I'd be so pissed.
Right?
Opposition.
So I guess it's only viewable on the dark web, like this dance with this former mob boss. They kind of talk about it in a lighthearted way, but then they start talking about some of the things that have helped the dark web gain the reputation that it has. And of course, there's quite a bit that we'll cover, but there's another video by BuzzFeed where they posted like these infamous headline stories talking about the dangers of the dark web. So I'll talk a little bit more about the titles. First and foremost, so what is the dark web? So according to Britannica, so there's the deep web and the dark web.
Most, oh shit, they say, they're different?
Yep. And I didn't know this. Okay. I thought for some reason, like the deep web sounded a little ominous, more ominous than the dark web. But then the deep web is like, but what's deeper than the dark?
Right.
Deep web contains mostly benign sites such as your password protected email accounts, certain parts of paid subscription services like Netflix, and sites that can be accessed only through an online form. So I guess like the deep web is what's easily accessible. The dark web is characterized by the use of encryption software that makes their users and their locations anonymous. According to identityiq.com, and some of these can be corroborated by the FBI and CIA websites. If you go to their public libraries and look up what these are, it'll come up. Dark web history is packed with government influence, underwriting the core principle that enables Tor, which is the onion routing to retain its users' anonymity. Y'all know what I'm trying to say.
Word.
Was developed and funded in the mid-1990s by the U.S. federal government. The onion routing was first developed at the U.S. Naval Research Laboratory by scientists Paul Silverson, David Kolschlag, and Michael Reed. The project's development continued the Defense Advanced Research Projects Agency until the U.S. Navy patented the onion routing in 1998. After onion routing was patented, additional computer scientists joined the original development team in 2002 and created the biggest project for onion routing yet. The Onion Routing Project, now commonly known as the Tor Project. The Navy would later release the code of the Tor under a free license. Then in 2006, several of the same scientists who developed Tor founded the Tor Project, a Massachusetts-based nonprofit organization. And so where are we now with the Tor?
This was created by essentially the Navy Was it another government entity or just the Navy?
It looks like it was at the U.S. Naval Research Laboratory.
Oh, okay. Interesting.
It was initially created to develop covert communications for the military as the power of internet grew, but then the Navy cut funding in 2004. And I guess to kind of stay in the game and kind of see where a lot of this illegal activity was happening,
right,
the government was still, I think the last thing that I saw on one of the videos on YouTube was that the government funded $80 million in 2013 to keep up the dark web.
Whoa. Okay.
One of the most infamous, though, things about the dark web is the Silk Road. And what is the Silk Road? According to this website, the Silk Road became a one-stop shop for just about every mind-altering substance that exists. According to the FBI, Dread Pirate Roberts earned $79.8 million in commission from all the transactions that involved, like, all this drug trade online.
That's crazy.
So the Silk Road hosted 1.2 million transactions between 950,079 users, totaling about $1.2 billion in value.
Just from the Silk Road. Oh my gosh.
Authorities were able to trace the pseudonym back to Ulbricht. So I guess this is the guy that created it, thanks to the efforts of an IRS investigator who was working with the DA on the Silk Road case in mid-2013.
I worked with a patient back in Boston that would buy meth online. And I was like, what? Like, legit asked him. I was like, how? He's like, you wouldn't get anything online. I was like, but meth? He's like, yeah, what the fuck? Tell me. And he did. He didn't tell me the websites or anything. But he was like, yeah, you use Bitcoin. Like, he was wicked smart, too. He was like a young guy. He was like, yeah, you can buy it. And then they deliver it to your house. I'm like, hot damn.
So I guess that was one of the most innovative or new things in that field that I didn't know much about Bitcoin. I just know it's like online currency. Is that even like the proper description?
I don't know. Is it not Chuck E. Cheese? I don't know.
Isn't that tokens?
I picture tokens.
Little golden tokens. The dark web created a unique opportunity for digital black markets to thrive and people began to take advantage. The transactions on the dark web are often carried out with Bitcoin or other cryptocurrencies, which are unregulated and difficult to trace back to the user.
Makes sense. Okay.
So I guess that's why you can just go off and buy meth on there.
Yeah. You can't trace it.
So that's a little bit of background on the dark web.
Okay.
So I clicked on the other BuzzFeed video that talks about, called People React to Disturbing Dark Web Stories. They're indeed disturbing. So the first one is about a British model kidnapped for dark web option, Italian police said. And this is through CNN. So a 20-year-old British model was kidnapped in Milan, Italy, to be auctioned off on a pornographic website on the dark web. The model, who has not been named, was assaulted, drugged, handcuffed, and stuck in a travel bag. A 30-year-old Polish national who resides in the UK was arrested on kidnapping charges. It says the model arrived in Milan on July 10th and already had a photo shoot booked through her agent for the following day. When she walked into the apartment where the photo shoot was supposed to take place, two men attacked her.
What? So was it not?
So it says when she walked into the apartment where the photo shoot was supposed to take place, that's when it's time. Yeah, you're right. They probably they set her up. So according to the Italian police, the suspect used encrypted accounts to ask the model's agent for $300,000 to stop the online auction from going ahead. He also allegedly told the agent that he was operating on behalf of the Black Death Group, an organization involved in illegal trafficking on the dark web, a layer of the internet accessible only through anonymizing networks like Tor. It was organized kidnapping online. And I think eventually, like, her name was released, and her name is Chloe Eiling.
Aw, poor Clo.
I know. How scary.
So it looked like she was held in captivity for 6 days. They fucking injected her with ketamine and put her in a remote farmhouse near Turin, Italy. Oh my God. And she was going to be auctioned off as a sex slave.
And they show the picture of Lucas Herba, a 30-year-old Polish national that was arrested on kidnapping charges.
And they had the fucking nerve to say that it wasn't true because I guess they found videos of her holding her kidnapper's hand. And they're like, well, if you weren't crying and if you weren't doing this, we don't believe you. It's like, well, one, she was drugged with ketamine. Two, she was obviously complying to not die. She's in a foreign country. Like, people need to fucking stop.
Because you weren't crying? Like, and there's no real handbook kind of respond to a kidnapping. Like,
no,
there's
no, not at all. No.
What? That is, that's very upsetting to hear that. Yeah, so eventually she started to do interviews about this awful experience. They start off the video talking about this first case. And the next one says, man buys grenades on the dark web, gets sentenced to life in prison. This is on the dark web. He was known under the pseudonym Cocaine King 247.
Oh, okay.
I see your username. Okay. 47-year-old Paul Christian Stellato was a career criminal with 36 convictions for 171 offenses. Oh, my.
Sir.
That is in late November 2016, Stellato contacted a vendor on the now defunct dark web marketplace Alphabet to inquire if hand grenades could be sent to an address in the UK. Attempting to reduce suspicions, he told the seller, I black someone to get it delivered as they don't know what it is. No matter what, these are not for terrorism affairs, domestic protection only.
Shut the
Sounding
fuck up.
Really suspicious, man. He was arrested on December 14, 2016, after the delivery, already under law enforcement's watchful eye, was made. Addressed to the name Richard Stewart, the grenades cost a lot, a total of $370.48, a sum he paid in bitcoins.
Oh, a deal.
I think part of like the messaging when he was inquiring about these grenades, he asked like some weird things like about what kind of damage the shrapnel could make. Like, is it enough to make a hole in the house or like something like that? That was another one. I was like, sir, what are you doing?
He got life for that?
Yep. Get sentenced to life.
Dang.
In prison. And he had a record that already preceded him. So
they're like, yeah, this guy, do not give him access to the internet.
Ever again. No email, no nothing. All right, so moving to a church elder's Ashley Madison affairs led him to the dark web and murder. It was May 2016, and this is found on the Washington Post. On the dark web, hackers had cracked into Besa Mafia, a website that claimed affiliation with Albanian organized crime and offered to arrange beatings and assassinations for a price. I guess this is kind of like a
hit for hire, I guess.
A hit for hire, yeah, or murder for hire. Emails between the site and potential clients, a treasure trove of illicit material leaked across the web, eventually landing at the FBI. As investigators sifted through the material, they zeroed in on an exchange between a user called Dog Day God, who they determined was trying to arrange the murder of a woman named Amy Altwine from a suburb outside St. Paul, Minnesota. It says in quotes, she tore my family apart by sleeping with my husband and stealing clients from my business, said Dog Day God. And so they wanted to make it seem like it was an accident. So the 43-year-old ran her own dog training business. She and her husband, Stephen, had met at a Christian college and were members of a local United Church of God congregation, according to news reports. Stephen served as a church elder and offered marriage counseling to couples. They had even adopted a son. Local law enforcement met with the Allens about the alleged threat, but there was little they could do about an anonymous internet user apparently planning to take her life beyond suggesting increased security. In August, Stephen got a permit for a 9mm Springfield XDS handgun. Dark web machinations suddenly took on new significance in November 2016 when Amy Altwine was discovered dead on the floor of her bedroom. Initially thought to be a suicide, police soon suspected foul play. Within months, they would allege Stephen Altwine was actually Dog Day God. He had killed his wife after Besa Mafia failed to come through. So the people he, I guess, had like wanting to pay for the murder didn't come through. And so he said, I'll take this into my own hands. The situation laid out by prosecutors was a mix of religious guilt and pity. Online, double lives, and desperate measures. According to the prosecutor, Stephen, an internet technology specialist, had begun cheating on his wife using the infidelity site Ashley Madison. But to him, divorce was not an option. He was seeing other women, but he didn't want to divorce her because of his position in the church.
Okay, so cheating and murder is better.
Mm-hmm.
Fucking ass. Murder is not the way to go. Guess what? God still hates you. Like,
And that's the number one rule of the True Crime Army through Margot's Military Murder Podcast. Divorce is better than murder.
Yes. And if you're super religious, guess what? Killing is on the commandments. Divorce is not.
Right. So far there's like this, the kidnapping, there's the buying of grenades. It's almost pretty close to terrorism.
Yeah.
And then there's this church elder coming to murder. That is wild. Like, I would want to interview this man and be like, what led you to the dark? Like, how did you learn that you could do murder for hire on there? Let's get a little bit more
Okay.
Deeper into the dark web. According to the U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement, Northeast Texas man who solicited murder, necrophilia, and cannibalism of a minor on dark web sentenced to federal prison.
Fuck. Of a minor.
Like, murder? Yeah, that's the number thing that catches, like, the headline, like, of a minor, followed by murder, necrophilia, and cannibalism. Not that any of these you could weigh as worse than the other, because they're all bad, they're terrible things. But murder, necrophilia, and cannibalism, I was stuck on that one for, like, a hot minute. I was like, sir, what? Huh?
Why?
Can you? Yeah. Who? What? Where? Texas? What's going on in Texas?
Goddamn.
It always starts Florida man or Texas man. No, just kidding.
Oh, always.
So this is who this person was. A 23-year-old Northeast Texas man who solicited the murder, necrophilia, and cannibalism of a minor on the dark web was sentenced to 40 years in federal prison for child exploitation violations in the Eastern District of Texas. Alexander Nathan Barter, a resident of Joaquin, Texas, was sentenced to 40 years in federal prison in order to submit to a lifetime of supervised release for attempted coercion and enticement of a minor in distribution of child pornography on 17 December by the U.S. District Judge Michael Truncale. He pleaded guilty to the charges December 20th, 2019. So that wasn't even like long ago, like a little over a year ago. As part of his plea agreement with the government, Barter agreed to be sentenced to a term of imprisonment of 20 years on each count, with each party reserving the right to request that the terms be sentenced concurrently or consecutively. Barter's counsel requested that the court impose a total term of imprisonment of 20 years. The government requested a sentence of 40 years imprisonment.
I'm hearing that he can get out.
That's kind of like lifetime. That's what I understood. Let's see how many counts there is.
No. Let's keep him in. I don't fucking so, creepy looking.
I guess what he posted on the internet on that's him?
Yes.
Oh my. Oh my. Okay. I did not know this was accessible. What? So I guess you could look him up by name and he'll come up and you'll
have an idea. Girl, this is just on regular Google. He looked like he would fucking try to eat and necrophilia someone. Gross.
So he said, according to information introduced as part of Barter's plea and at sentences in October 2018, Barter posted an ad on a dark website stating, "I'd like to try necrophilia and cannibalism and see how it feels to take a life. If you'd be willing to let me kill you, are in the United States, preferably in the South, and can travel by car, contact me." Oh my, that sounds, Sarah, like you're not trying to like sell like your car on Craigslist.
Or like, hey, may I test out your scooter? This motherfucker. Yeah. If you'd be willing. No, I will not be willing. Fuck off.
Like, an undercover HSI special agent saw the ad and responding using the persona of a father with a 13-year-old daughter. So between October 9th and October 19, 2018, Barter and the undercover special agent exchanged a series of messages that included Barter's repeated interest in killing, raping, and eating the 13-year-old child. Barter provided the undercover with instructions on traveling to Florida to Shelby County, Texas, what to tell the child to get her to agree to travel, and how to conceal evidence of the crime. Once Barter arrived at the designated site to meet with a knife, trash bag, cell phone, and a tablet.
The fuck? What are you doing with your tablet?
Right?
Just in case.
I'm guessing either he wanted to do this and film it for his gratification. True. Or, oh.
Yeah.
That is the case of this Northeast Texas man who solicited murder, necrophilia, and cannibalism of a minor.
I'm not ready to move on. Hold on. I need a second.
And even on the BuzzFeed video, like the person that are reading these out loud and giving like their reactions, they're just like us. They're like, what? Oh my God. Just like the shock. Like,
we're doing this because we've heard some shit and like this is not new to us. This is a new one. As you talk about the dark web, I can only imagine if this was out in the 70s when serial killers were fucking rampant. If they had access to this, I mean, I think more would be caught because there's thankfully like a better trail.
Mm-hmm.
But there would be some like crazy ass shit.
Some wild stuff. Like the BTK killer, like his demise was a floppy disk.
Because he didn't know.
Because how can they lie to him?
Oh my God. Can you imagine the carnage Ted Bundy could do if he had dating profiles? back in the day.
And they took advantage of the fact that women or survivors will not come forward because of the shame and the stigma.
Absolutely.
So they just go on about their lives, and they do this knowingly that they will not come forward because of that. Mm-hmm. So they just take it like it's not right or fair, and it's just mm-hmm. it's just awful that this happened.
Yeah.
Like, they're just awful. You have kidnapping, murder for hire, all this grenades, almost slash terrorism, like all this stuff, right? But the most saddest and heartbreaking of cases, like, they leave towards the end.
Oh, shit.
And so I got this from BBC News, and the title goes, German couple jailed for selling son to pedophiles on dark. It starts with, a woman who sold her son to pedophiles on the darknet has been jailed for 12 years and 6 months by a court in southern Germany. The Freiburg court also jailed her partner, the boy's stepfather, for 12 years. The boy was 9 when the trial began in June.
Oh, poor baby.
The German nationals, 48 and 39-year-old, had sexually abused the boy themselves for at least 2 years. The darknet is an interest area beyond the reach of mainstream. 5 other men have also been prosecuted in connection with the abuse. The couple were found guilty of rape, aggravated sexual assault of children, forced prostitution, and distribution of child pornography. The boy is now living with foster parents. The couple must now pay $49,200 in damages to the boy and to the 3-year-old girl who was also abused by them. What? That, to me, that sounds like, oh, this is just me personally, but, and I don't know much about law, but wouldn't this like account for maybe like,
this is me professionally. What the fuck is 12 years? Maybe it's because it's overseas, but I know just based on all of the podcasts I've been listening to when it comes to like human trafficking or child exploitation, it's federal and the numbers have conviction or time in prison has been much higher. Especially when it's compounding like that, where it the exploitation of the children and then the actual rape too. 12 years.
Oh, just so heart-wrenching, and it twists your stomach. But part of the article, it states, prosecutors say the boy was subjected to more than 60 serious sex attacks, many of which were filmed.
Oh no.
So 12 years. What was 12 years?
Wow.
Says German media report that child welfare authorities in Baden-Württemberg state have been heavily criticized for failing to stop the couple's abuse. The boy had been removed from the couple temporarily by social workers, but was then handed back to them. Spiegel News website reports that welfare officers had not exchanged information about the case that could have led them to the couple's crimes. According to case psychiatrist Hartmut Plains, quoted by Spiegel, the mother's claim that she was enthralled to her partner when she committed the abuse was false. She did not explain her actions, but her partner did speak a lot in court during the 2-month trial. She was enthralled. What does that mean?
You know, fuck you. She's trying to say like, oh no, my partner made me do it because I love him so much.
Oh, gotcha. No, it's almost like
like a Stockholm syndrome type of deal.
Gotcha. Were they like sympathizing with the abuser? And
yes. Yeah, that's what she was trying to claim. No boo. Oh, man. That reminds me of a really good podcast series called Hunting Warhead. Have you heard of that one?
Oh, yeah.
Dude, listen to it. You'd really like it. It's fucking dark, but it opens up with one of the investigators. He's like, I think he's an investigative journalist. He creates his investigation of a specific, trying to find this dark web pedophilia, sex abuse ring, and then he connects with the head leader of that ring in Australia. So he flies down either Australia or New Zealand and then goes to confront them about it, and it just like opens up this huge story and how these, I think, 3 Americans got convicted for being the ringleader. It's really good.
I'll look into it. What was the name of it again?
Hunting Warhead. Disclaimer, it's very descriptive, and there's a lot of obviously child sex abuse described, because that's clearly, you know, that's what it's about. Holy fuck. But they do a really good job with like the journalism part too.
Kind of what it feels like. Maybe not like investigative work, but seeing how people report on it and what's available to the public and putting pieces together is interesting. Especially through the podcast, because I'm learning like a lot that I never knew was out there.
Right. So we're pretty much like CIA agents is what you're saying.
Almost. Where's our badge?
Yeah, right. I'll go ahead and take all my badges now, please.
But RAs.
Oh my God,
just terrible, terrible cases. Awful. So I thought, what could be worse? Like, what could... And I got my answer towards the end of the video. Because, you know, all these storylines, they do them like in a timeline and they each person like describes it and they give their reaction, right? I got this from the website. It's called End Ritual Abuse. And the headline reads, Child Rape and Torture Materials on the Dark Web, Peter Scully and Beyond. On June 13, 2018, a Philippines court sentenced Australian businessman Peter Scully to life in prison for one count of human trafficking and five counts of rape by sexual assault of underage girls. He faces up to 60 more charges of torture, murder, and abuse against children. And it's really wild because, you know, they describe him as, I guess you can kind of see the difference where he still holds his title of businessman, Australian businessman.
Yeah, no, I don't give a flying fuck what you are.
You should know what he is. He's a
pedophile. Mm-hmm. Sex deviant.
And it says that there's been other sources that report that Scully filmed the rape and torture of children for an international pedophile ring without describing him as the ring's mastermind. This person went on to what it describes as one of the most disturbing items alleged to have been produced by Scully and seized in the Philippines is a series of films entitled Daisy's Destruction, for which customers allegedly paid up to $10,000 to view. It briefly describes what those series of films include, but I will not talk about it. You can look it up for yourself because it's very disturbing. One of the most horrific things you can think of doing to children is just overall sad. He ended up naming six co-defendants, and I guess were involved in this ring as well. I did not know that this had happened.
No, so I had no idea.
They call them child abuse materials, and I guess they can be sold on the dark web. Part of the work that anti-trafficking organizations do, especially on the internet, is help catch the URLs for which you can access these materials, report them to like places like the FBI or internationally, whatever the equivalent of that entity is, so they can take them off the internet and I guess kind of help pursue or build a case to identify like who's leading all of this and who's helped distributing all of this. This is one of those where I'm just so shocked and so disgusted, and especially because one of the statistics that I found and it's included in the video is that I think somewhere like less than 50% of material that's on the dark web involves any kind of criminal activity. One of the things that you can do is I guess pay like $68 and then you can buy a PayPal account with like $4,000 in it.
What?
Yeah, things like that. Or like that silly video that I was talking about with the former mob boss. I guess that's what makes up most of it, right? Like material like this doesn't make up most of it. And the original purpose was having like a way to stay anonymous while being online. But that can obviously turn into like a gateway to many other horrible
things. Yeah, there's no accountability and no repercussions.
Yeah, and I guess that's why the government has a pretty good stakeholder funding into it, because I think that kind of helps track and monitor a lot of criminal activities going on.
So it's like a catch-22.
I know. It's like, I guess that was like six storylines that we talked about. Including like some weird, bizarre criminal act. This is more like the exception than the rule because of what I learned.
Yeah.
But it still happens and it still needs to be tracked and monitored, and they still need to, you know, continue to hold people accountable. So,
and those are just one case. Like that's still one too many of any of that. Like that is crazy.
Mm-hmm.
I don't want to be, I do want to be a part of it in regards to like tracking them down. I want to be part of that team. I'm obsessed. Did you ever watch How to Catch a Predator? Growing up,
is that the person that like they lure like people that are soliciting the stuff, and then they set up like
them? That's entrapment.
My bad.
No, but you're right. It's Chris Hansen. He's a journalist with NBC News, or was. He doesn't do it anymore. But they're all on YouTube, and they're amazing. It was just a series that he did where there was a private vigilante group that would online and chat, right? So they were not saying like, hey, I'm 12, who wants to, you know, do things with me? They would just be in the chat, and then a lot of times it was males would connect with them. And these people that were pretending to be 12, 13, you know, minors, were grown-ass men and women, would be like, I'm only 12 or 13. And then they would say it a lot. And the guys would be like, it's fine, and be like, hella gross. And they would have that all on record. So then they would set up a meeting spot. So they would rent someone's house and have hidden cameras. Then they had a decoy, they called. It was always a like over 18 actress or actor that looked underage. Like, and they'd be like, oh, come in, I'm just gonna. And they would keep a lot of distance between them. And then the dudes would get like kind of comfortable and be like all gross. And then Chris Hansen would come out. And he'd be like, oh, so like he would take whatever they said, like one guy. One guy, I don't even remember what he was saying, but it would be so funny. He would just pop out and you see the guys be like, oh, hey, and they don't know that they're being recorded, give out some like bullshit lie. His like big thing that he would say is, have a seat, have a seat. So he would have them sit down and then like ask them what's going on, and they would just blatantly lie about it. And he'd be like, oh, really? And he'd bring out the motherfucking receipts. He would bring out the text messages, print out, and be like, so when you told her that you wanted her to suck your blank, like, he would say it.
Here's so the evidence. You said this. Yep. You know, and I think I remember.
Yeah, it was like in the early 2000s, if not late 90s. He did it again, but on his own with, I think, police department in Pennsylvania. And so they did their own operation. So he's amazing. There was one day that he said that they had at least 20, they had arrested 20 dudes trying to solicit a minor that actually showed up.
I think I remember one of the videos where even one of like the subjects was like, I wasn't gonna do anything, and then he was like, why show up?
They would be like, either I wasn't gonna do anything, I'm just her friend, or two, I came to tell her not to do anything and to be careful. Okay,
huh? No. Bull.
Yeah, right. We should totally do an episode where we're watching an episode of that.
I think when it comes to pedophilia, there's not much research when it comes to treatment. More than likely, it's always when they have already been charged of a crime. Like, we know it's a DSM-5. Like most conditions, they're probably underreported. And what we know so far is because of the data we can collect and people that are willing to say, hey, like, I've experienced this.
Oh, absolutely.
But when it comes to, like you're saying, like pedophilia or one of those paraphilic disorders, there's not much out there. All the treatment that does exist is just when they're already in prison.
Reactive, absolutely. Yeah, that's a really good point. And there is a really good article that I had mentioned in the BTK episode with Dr. Sorrentino. I'm trying to pull up her information because she actually talks about that clinical treatment piece in assessment. So the treatment is focused on decreasing the arousal to the deviant sexual behavior rather than extinguishing the sexual orientation, which is interesting. So you're not trying to stop their thoughts, I guess, necessarily, like their preference or their pull for it. You're decreasing that physiological arousal that they have. The evaluation of an individual with problematic sexual behavior includes both a clinical, which is subjective, and then testing objective component. The clinical interview is what we're familiar with, right? It's the getting the detailed sexual history, inquiring about childhood exposure to sexual acts, sexual partners, sexual functioning, which includes like masturbation pattern. And a general medical and psychiatric history should be obtained to identify psychiatric comorbidity or medical conditions that mimic paraphilias, which could be like traumatic brain injuries and other stuff. But that is very subjective because, again, it's based on what the patient is reporting, right? So a lot of times, of course, there's such a stigma and shame to it. So they're going to be unwilling to disclose their sexual interest. So objective testing is used to determine the sexual interest. So that looks like sexual history polygraphs, ABLE screen, which is associating visual reaction time with sexual interest, and the penile plethysmograph, which is pretty much measuring your boner to sexual stimuli.
I think I just heard of that like 2-3 weeks ago, actually.
Did you?
I didn't know that. Yeah.
I didn't know it existed until I did the research for BTK. Research has found that the most effective treatment for sexual offenders is medication, behavioral therapy, social skills training, such as education, cognitive behavioral therapy, and then monitoring the polygraph and their penile boner measurer. At least there's something there. Yeah, like you said, it's post-crime, right? Post-offending.
And we're not even sure, like, if people that have these conditions, like, what are they doing on their own to prevent acting on them? Because I think you made, like, a good point on the last episode that there's a lot of people have some antisocial traits or the actual full-blown diagnosis, but not all of them act on it. Like, not all of them act on murder. Mm-hmm. And so I guess similar to, and this is not us, like, justifying or pardoning or anything like that when it comes to crimes that have been committed against children or minors. We're just trying to kind of, I guess, the discussion in all, like, from a clinical perspective is that, you know, this is a condition that's included in the DSM. It's not often talked about. And so there's a lot of missing pieces in the literature and the body of knowledge of what treatment can look like and how people right. are coping with it right now to not act right. on those thoughts or urges.
And can things be rehabilitated? And that's where I think our interest has been sparked and really blossomed with mental health and this true crime is that, like, forensic piece of at what point could Ted Bundy or BTK could have been prevented if we really broke it down and looked at them as humans. Like, yes, we look at the crimes and their fucking irrational thoughts and think, like, you are a fucking monster. And they did do things. But I think what really interested me with BTK, because he was a very loving father and a loving husband. That's without a doubt present in his life. So, like, how was he able to hold that peace, not able to not kill? And, you know, I think there's that compulsion. So, like, what clinical work could have been done to help him rein that compulsion to kill? And I wonder for him, like, is it the sex piece? Like, did he feel so much shame from his interest in S&M that he felt like he had to kill the women to do his act?
Mm-hmm. I think that's a very valid question and leaves me speechless because, you know, at the end of the day, like, he can only answer that. And even with his answer, it'd be interesting to see how he responds to that question, because even, like, with the 10 Bundy tapes, like, yeah. Homo used, like, third person to admit
yes.
very, like, narcissistic, like, nonchalant. Oh. Justification for all the crimes that he committed.
Dissociation and denial as a, which I feel like is what BTK and Ted Bundy and I'm sure all the other killers did, was that third person, such a removal of themselves that is a tactic to justify what the horrible things they did. Like, even BTK killer, he was like, I'm still a good man. I'm a family man. During his confessions, I'm pretty sure during his testimony in the court, he had the nerve to say that.
That is wild.
It's such an interesting topic.
Right. Yeah. Oh, man. Well, this was the dark web. Oh,
thank you for doing that research. That shit is intense.
Thank you for tuning in, folks.
Bye.
Till next time, homies.
Thank you for joining us, and be sure to come back next week where we continue to explore true crime, psychology, the paranormal, mental health, and everything in between. We would love to hear from you, so email us at millennialtherapistspod@gmail.com with your ghost stories, paranormal experiences, questions about therapy and counseling, or the social work field. And don't forget to share, subscribe, and review wherever you listen to your favorite podcasts.
Remember, you are valued, you are enough,
and you are not alone.
Please subscribe and review. Bye-bye.
Although we are licensed mental health therapists and may cover therapy-related subjects, the topics in this podcast should not substitute professional, psychological, or medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment.
If you are a victim of a crime, which includes but not limited to stalking, human trafficking, financial crimes, or sexual assault, please know the Victim Connect Resource Center can help. They are a referral helpline where crime victims can learn about their rights and options confidentially and compassionately. A traditional telephone-based helpline is 1-855-4-VICTIM or 1-855-484-2846. Or you can connect with them at chat.victimconnect.org or at the website victimconnect.org.
If you or someone you know is in crisis, whether they are considering suicide or not, please call the toll-free lifeline available 24/7 across the United States by calling 1-800-273-8255 or visit suicidepreventionlifeline.org. U.S. and Canadian listeners can also text HOME to 741-741 to connect with a trained crisis counselor. U.K. listeners text HOME to 85258, and Ireland listeners text HOME to 50808. For more mental health resources and support, international listeners can visit the website unitedgmh.org/mental-health-support to find more mental health services and resources.
And if you are a veteran in crisis or concerned about one, connect with the Veteran Crisis Line to reach caring, qualified responders with the Department of Veterans Affairs at 1-800-273-8255 and press 1, or text 838-255. Or you can always visit veteranscrisisline.net.
If you or anyone you know may be experiencing domestic violence, you can find resources and support with the National Domestic Violence Hotline. Visit thehotline.org or call 1-800-799-7233.